I'm Bob Franklin. Thanks for joining me. On this edition of Like It Is, a portrait of the late Ethel Ennis, an American jazz musician whose career spanned seven decades.
As part of the Notable Black Women of Maryland series, which is sponsored by the Maryland Humanities Council and the University of Maryland Eastern Shore, it gives me great pleasure to have as my guest today the internationally acclaimed jazz singer Ethel Ennis. Miss Ennis is one of the most celebrated jazz-oriented singers from Baltimore since Billie Holiday. Ella Fitzgerald, Sarah Vaughan, Peggy Lee, Duke Ellington, and Frank Sinatra, among others, have recognized Miss Ennis as one of the best singers of her generation. Thank you, Miss Ennis, for joining me today on Like It Is.
Listen, I thank you for the invite, Bob.
Great, great. In 1958, you received international acclaim when, after a national search, Benny Goodman selected you to tour with his all-star band, which toured Western Europe and was a highlight at the Brussels World Fair. Can you revisit that moment and tell us how you felt about that selection?
We're going back some years.
Just a little bit.
Yes. Well, it's kind of funny. At the time, I was recording with Capitol Records, and during my recording session, the photographer came up to me and said, "You know what? Your voice sounds like it would be just right for the Benny Goodman's band, which will be touring Europe and ending up at the Brussels World Fair." And I said, "Oh, really?" So I found out that he was once the band boy with Benny Goodman's band. And he said, "You should go over to a certain hotel in a certain suite and go in for an audition." I said, "Oh, okay." So I told my then manager, you know, all about it, and he accompanied me there for the audition. And I accompanied myself on piano singing, "I'll Take Romance, da-da-dee-doo-doo," you know, singing all that good stuff. And Benny Goodman listened and smiled, a nice warm smile, and that was just it. It was a smile like, "Don't call me, I'll call you." So I returned, this was all happening in New York, and I returned to Baltimore at home and continued my work at the club at the Red Fox. And 2 weeks later, after my audition in New York, I got the telegram to come in for rehearsal. So that's how it all started, my tour to Europe in 1958. And the male vocalist at that time was Jimmy Rushing, so we had wonderful duets to sing, and it was just a wonderful tour. And Benny Goodman at that time was a man of few words, and you don't bother him, he doesn't bother you. So it was a good tour.
What were your thoughts of Benny Goodman?
Well, he was a quiet man. He was definite on what kind of music he wanted to play, because I remember that one of the rehearsals before going on the tour, Duke Ellington sent over a piece of music, and, you know, for him to play on the tour. And he, you know, played a couple of notes, and then it was just a little, it wasn't to his liking, I'll put it that way, so he just didn't include that in the repertoire. So he was definite on what kind of music he wanted to play. He was definite on musicians. He wanted working with him. He did fire a couple of musicians before going on tour.
Would you say he was meticulous?
Just a wee bit. No, it's good to know what you want.
Okay. You made many tours of Europe and North America, but you avoided the entertainment mainstream by remaining in Baltimore. Some critics misread this posture as retreat or fear of success. Would you elaborate on that assertion?
Oh, you want me to elaborate?
Please.
Well, it's funny. People expect for you to, as they say, grab that brass ring, you know, "Hey, this is your time, this is it, this is your opportunity." You know, it doesn't knock all the time. But once you find out how the show goes on, how all the unglamorizing parts of the music industry, once you understand what really goes on, you say, well, I don't know if I want to be manipulated. I don't know if I want to be pigeonholed. And I felt that I had more to give than they were willing to let me give. So I said, I'll just, you know, kind of get out of the mainstream and live my life. And what I sing will come from what I have learned from life. And I feel that I do have substance, and I'm happy with myself. I would hate the idea of doing a little of Ethel and, you know, like 10%. Oh, this is fine, Ethel. This is what we want from you, and I got 90% more over here to do, you know. And I said, no, we just want this. And I said, no, that's not nice. It's like cutting you and using part of you when you want to give all. So that's why I guess you might say I didn't, the reason why I didn't stay in the mainstream.
Do you feel content?
Oh, my goodness, yes, no regrets at all.
No regrets. You wouldn't, if you had to do it again, you would do it the
same
way?
Indeed, I would. This is wonderful.
America cringed when Roseanne Barr did her rendition of the national anthem, and Americans felt pride when Whitney Houston did her rendition of the nation's anthem. But many may not know that you were the first performer to sing the national anthem solo a cappella before an international audience at former President Nixon's second inauguration. What special significance did performing the national anthem hold for you?
Well, at that time, we're talking about the very first time I did it solo a cappella was at Nixon's convention, I think, yeah, but that was in, I think, in Florida in 72. And we're in the Vietnam conflict, and America was hurting. I mean, it was, you know, a lot of people didn't want this war, and they were, it was just a bad, bad war. And America was hurting, and I thought singing the anthem the way I did, which some people call it was a lullaby, some said it was a blues, some said it was gospel. Everyone has their own, you know, idea of, you know, what's being heard. And I said, okay, it's almost singing the song as a lullaby, cradling the country and trying to bring peace to it, you know. So that's why it was kind of neat to do it with just, you know, the Almighty and, you know, my voice. So it was really, really exciting to see when once I was announced to sing the anthem, because it's at the end of the inauguration. Everybody is, you know, turning their backs and going to their cars. And here I am singing the anthem with just the voice, and then those backs turn, I saw faces, and people were just standing there and said, oh, we never heard it like this before. And of course, the compliments were numerous. And I have sung since that time, every time, the national anthem solo a cappella. And it's so funny, I had music. My music is still brand new. I had, you know, written for that special occasion, but it was never used.
Would it be too much out of line to ask you to maybe give just a note or two of...
Well, it would be because, you know, it's early and it's... and you can't hear how... I can't believe how heavy my voice sounds all of a sudden. But you wanted to hear the anthem?
Just a little bit.
Well, you were talking about when Roseanne Barr sang the anthem. Well, she's not a singer, right?
Right.
So you wouldn't expect for her to, you know, be melodious. So, but let's sing. Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight O'er the ramparts we watch, were so gallantly streaming, and the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through the night that our flag was still there. Oh, say does the Star-Spangled Banner yet wave o'er the land of the free? And the home of the brave.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Thank you very, very much. That was very beautiful.
You would do that to me, Bob.
That's great. That's singing it like it is, I'll tell you.
Thanks.
You had many firsts in 1988 in Xiamen, the People's Republic of China. You represented the United States in the International Festival for the Performing Arts, the first in modern China. Tell us about that experience.
Well, it was a funny, funny experience to begin with, because 4 days prior to being in China, we were asked to be in Xiamen, which is our sister city in Baltimore, and we had to really get our visas together and rush, and get all around, and everything was taken care of, and we got there finally. And Japan was represented there along with New Zealand and the Philippines, right? I'm trying to remember this. So, of course, my very first time in China, and I don't know any Chinese. but I did make an attempt to learn a song, a kind of a folk song in Chinese. I did sing it and was well received. They knew I was trying, so that was just wonderful for them. And I took two musicians with me. My husband accompanied us, and boy, it was just funny. We were the smallest entourage. Everyone else had 20 people, 15 people. We had four, you know. So I had a bassist and a pianist, to accompany me. And we put on a show, and I think we were well received. It's very strange over there. I guess we were well received.
Okay. Let's talk about the music that you love, jazz. What has been the most revolutionary change in jazz that you've seen during your career?
The word jazz. Okay, you're speaking of jazz from the 50s, the 60s, the 40s?
Let's say a combination of jazz from those particular eras.
Mm. Well, of course, it's electrified, which is not all bad. It's not quite as free, I feel, as it used to be. Of course, during the bop era, the bop era, you would do the head and then fill. And you just go on and on as you improvise, as you thought of new ideas. I mean, the time was there. Of course, now things are a little more structured. And everybody's looking for high points, They don't have time to wait to hear what you have to say. They want to, hurry and comprise it and compress it, and there it is. And that's one of the things it's not quite as free.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of my Like It Is interview with the late Ethel Ennis, Baltimore's First Lady of Jazz.
What makes your music so enduring?
Are you telling me that my music is enduring?
Yes.
Well, I guess I'm still striving. I still feel that I have something to say. So I will always, you know, I really believe the best is yet to come for me when it comes to recording. And I think expressing myself through what I have learned about life will make a difference. So I guess that's it.
And what are some of the lessons of life that you've learned?
Oh, good, Bob. Well, I tell you, I found that, being, and when I say being, well, I should start with something that affected me at the death of my grandmother. And I think that's when my spirituality really blossomed and say, hey, here I am, use me. And I do call this spirituality, this wonderful consciousness, this wonderful energy, I call it soft power. And it, I believe it's something that we all have. I think it's our commonality in the whole world. And it's something that we all have and you can use, and it's your truth. And when you stem from the truth, you can't go wrong. And I guess that's where I'm coming from.
You answered part of my next question, so I'm going to ask it anyway.
Okay.
You stated that your best recordings are yet to be made.
Yeah.
And subsequently, you're putting the concept of soft power to music. Can you delve a little further into what soft power actually is?
Well, like I said, I think it's our spirituality, and it's our truth, and our truth is the truth. And I believe that a lot of people are so befuddled, and they have problems, and they have questions. And I think if you pray, meditate, chant, anything that will get you centered and focused and kind of lasered, that it's within. It's never out. You have to kind of go in and be quiet. So I remember reading some of my grandmother's personal papers, and she had a line in there that appropriate for what you're asking. Each of us should take a portion of each day just to be quiet, just to be alone. And that's the time to meditate and chant and just be, talk to yourself, because it's very important, because you got a lot of stuff. I believe when you come into this world, we're already programmed. What we got to do is find out what that is and be it. Because so many of us doing so many things that we don't want to do, and you don't have to do that.
What is it that keeps Ethel Ennis going?
That belief, because it's always new. It's always steady. It's always the same, but different. And I love that.
Billie Holiday acknowledged you as a, quote, musical singer with great voice who doesn't fake. What are your thoughts on Billie Holiday?
Oh, well, I wasn't a fan of Billie's for a long, long time.
Why?
Well, when I was coming up and, you know, listening to music, I was listening to instrumentalists. And a friend of mine, Sherry Baker, who was a hairdresser, said he was just a great fan, a fan. I mean, he was a friend and fan of Billie Holiday. So he was visiting her in New York, one weekend. And the phone rings. I'm in Baltimore. The phone rings, and it's about 3 or 4 in the morning. And I hear this voice on the other end of the line. Hello, I'm Billie Holiday. I said, oh, I hung up the phone. So Sherry rang me back and said, Ethel, it's really Billie Holiday. I'm up here visiting. She wants to talk to you because she heard your new recording. It was my very first recording, Jubilee. And she just wanted, you know, praise you and give you, you know, thank you and wonderful, you know, thank yous. So I said, okay. So when she got on the phone, and she was very, very nice, and she said she liked my voice and she liked what I was doing. And like it was quoted that I didn't fake. Now, I don't know what she meant by that. I was just singing from Ethel, you know. I didn't have anybody in mind. I wasn't patterning myself after anyone. And that's another thing I like to tell, you know, young performers, do not copy. Find your own sound. Because we're all originals. And if you're going to copy someone else's style, you can only be second best.
Very nicely stated. Some other very noteworthy performers had high marks for you, had very high compliments, I should say. I want to name a few and have you briefly elaborate on each. Mm. Ella Fitzgerald, Sarah Vaughan, Peggy Lee, Duke Ellington, Frank Sinatra. They recognize you as one of the best singers of your generation. Briefly, give me your thoughts on those artists.
Well, okay, Ella, there's a quote. She said she likes my sound and she likes my phrasing, which was a wonderful compliment to me. And I guess she took note of that because I'm very much interested in the lyric. Music is very important, but I like to not just sing words, but I like the words to come out like in a conversation. So that was a wonderful compliment. Frank Sinatra, well, fine. We've worked together at the White House, and he, you know, complimented me. And I remember him. I remember him telling me that he went into the song "Lush Life." He went into the studio. He said, three times, Ethel, I went in it three times. Never came out with Lush Life. So I guess I don't know what he's going to do before he dies or what. But that was one tune that really got him going. Duke Ellington was wonderful working with him. This was going back maybe before you were born. The Telephone Hour, the Bell Telephone Hour. And it was a wonderful week working with him in New York just to do that at one show, which was live. No tape at all, just live. And he was just marvelous, and he's a wonderful teacher, always a teacher. He was always a teacher as well as a performer. And what's the other? Oh, Peggy Lee was very nice. We used to hold hands and sing in L.A., and I always loved her sound because it was sultry. You know, in my early years, my voice was so high and so angelic, and I said, ooh, I want to sound smoky and sultry, and I just love to hear her sing. Her breathiness was just wonderful.
And last and certainly not least, Sarah Vaughan.
Sarah is all up there, all by herself. This, the voice, and she was really the voice. I heard her sing, and she paid me a wonderful compliment, too. I mean, it's just nice, but listening to her sing back in, I think it was 65, at the Monterey Jazz Festival, and she sang Maria. And it was just, to me, at that moment while she was singing, it was just wonderful. It's almost like the world stood still, and all you could hear was this beautiful, beautiful voice. It was perfect. It was excellent. It was inspiring. And, I mean, just, she's all by herself. She could sing anything.
Let me ask, should universities, high schools and elementary schools place more of an emphasis on jazz, because it seems as though our youth really don't understand or doesn't have a feel for what jazz really is? Do you think we should have some type of a jazz 101 very early in the curriculums at these schools?
Well, yeah, of course. Why not? Jazz is so funny. I mean, what is jazz to you? What is jazz to the next person? What is jazz to me? Okay, jazz to me is, the kids are doing jazz anyway because it's at the spur of the moment. It's what you feel at that moment that you bring forth musically. And, I mean, you can do it. You can jazz up your clothes. You can jazz up your recipes. You can jazz up. I mean, it's making do with what you got. And I think the African-American is jazz anyway. You're right. It should be implemented. It should be part of the curriculum.
I want you to say it first on Like It Is. What's coming next for Ethel Ennis? Can you give us a sneak preview of what the best is yet to come?
Well, no. Sneak preview of... I was trying to think. I do have some, some tunes on tape, which haven't been actually released. But it would be things like, I'm two projects I'm doing. It's a dual project. One will probably be songs that, new versions of old songs, I put it that way. And then the Soft Power project will be things like Soft Power, the song Soft Power, and Everybody Look at My Face, and Feeling Your Love, Tune for Today, and Color Us Love, things like that. Wonderful titles, right, Bob?
Sounds very good to me. My guest today has been the one and only Ethel Ennis. Ms. Ennis, thank you for being a guest on Like It Is.
Oh, thank you, Bob.
Ethel Ennis participated in the Notable Black Women of Maryland series sponsored by the Maryland Humanities Council and the University of Maryland Eastern Shore.
This was an encore recording with the late Ethel Ennis, Baltimore's First Lady of Jazz. Ms. Ennis passed away February 7, 2019. I'm Bob Franklin. I'll be back next week with 30 more minutes of good conversation on another edition of Like It Is.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.